Hi, my name's Darren Ray. I'm a climate scientist at the University of Adelaide. So thanks for having me here today, Sue.
Welcome, and thanks for coming and doing an interview here with me at Christie Walk, where I live, on unceded Gunnerland. And we've just had an incredible conversation that sort of blew my mind about some significant changes that have been happening, perhaps in the last 5 years. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so people would have been hearing stories and news about record ocean temperatures and, you know, record warmest global temperatures. So we've had a consecutive run of 10 months now with highest on record global temperatures, record ocean temperatures in many parts of the world, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere and in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Like off the charts sort of stuff. And here in Australia, we've been experiencing a switch from La Nina conditions summer before in 2022-23, and we've gone into an El Nino event in the summer of 2023-24. But it's been an unusual one because it's actually been relatively wet for Australia. So there's been a lot of really, really interesting stuff happening from a climate science perspective. But it's pointing to some deeper issues, which are pretty concerning. One of the things that seems to be happening with this, Sue, is there's one of the things that people might not have heard about is this, the it points to issues in terms of our understanding of the impact of what we call aerosol particles on the climate system. So when we burn things, whether that's wood from trees or coal or even gas or petrol, you get fine particles that come out as a result of the combustion process. And one of the things that's relevant to shipping. So when ships run around, they burn fuel, and that fuel has for many decades now had quite high sulfur content in it. And what that's meant is As shipping levels have increased significantly over the 20th century and the 21st century, there's been increasing amounts of sulfur particles coming into the atmosphere from the burning of shipping fuel over the oceans. Now, those particles provide condensation sites for cloud to form. So essentially what's been going on is that there's been large amounts of cloud forming over the oceans, which are 7/10 of the world's area, surface area. And they reflect away, so those combustion particles reflect away sun's energy. But a couple of years ago, the International Maritime Organization mandated a decrease in sulfur content in fuel. And what that's meant is been a massive, like about an 80% decrease in the amount of sulfur particles coming out of shipping. And that means much less cloud formation, which is revealing, which means we're getting a lot more of the sun's energy is making it to the surface of the oceans and warming up the oceans. And that's one of the significant reasons why we're seeing record ocean temperatures in the last couple
of
years.
When did the sulfur start decreasing?
It was about 2 years ago.
Yeah,
two or three years ago. So there is, you can see that that pattern, and it is concentrated in areas where the shipping is highest, so the North Atlantic, the Pacific. Interestingly, around Australia is a pretty active shipping area, and through sort of Southeast Asia and China Sea, that sort of thing as well.
Is there any particular shipping or just all ships?
Well, all ships really.
Yeah.
Pretty much all ships are burning fairly crude product of the oil refining process. And so, you know, like 100 years or so ago, it was used to be coal, but they switched over to burning shipping oil. So what does that mean? So people like climate scientists like James Hansen, for instance, have been looking at this and going, well, what this is suggesting is we've been massively underestimating the cooling effect from aerosols. And the aerosol, the overall cooling influence of aerosols is actually pretty tricky to estimate accurately. And we haven't had very good instruments until maybe the last 20 years or so to actually measure what's going on with that.
How do you measure that?
So you use satellites and you use ground-based solar radiation measurements.
Okay.
And satellite data to basically measure the amount of heat, compare the amount of heat getting out of the surface and solar energy getting to the surface compared to what's coming, the heat coming out of the atmosphere. So you work out these the Earth's energy balance. So what this is all suggesting is that Hansen might be on the right path, in that the cooling effect of aerosols is being really massively underestimated. And what that means is, when you run the models, what they're doing is balancing out the warming effect from greenhouse gases with the cooling effect from the aerosols, and basically adjusting the physics or parameters in the model to get, by comparison with the observed past temperature, you know, when that all sort of balances out properly, then you say, okay, well, the physics and the model are set up well, so we'll use this model with these particular, you know, forcing adjustments. But what this suggests is that the greenhouse gas influence, the sensitivity of the climate system to increase the greenhouse gases, might well be quite significantly more than what we thought, because we've been underestimating the cooling influence from aerosols. Now, that's pretty concerning, because so James Hansen is suggesting, instead of warming, if we double carbon dioxide, the models work so far suggest it's about 3 degrees total warming we might get. What this suggests is it might be more like 5 to 5.5 degrees of warming from a doubling of carbon dioxide. Now, that's pretty concerning. That suggests that as aerosol pollution continues to decrease over the coming decades, we might see stronger temperature increases than anticipated. Increases that, you know, could be almost double what we're anticipating.
And that relates to actual temperature.
So that's the global temperature influence.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing with this is this sort of step change warming of the oceans that we're seeing is, so basically with this removal of the cooling influence from shipping, what this is suggesting is that we've essentially seen a step change in terms of the warming of the oceans that's not going to come back, it's going to stay there. There's the El Niño La Niña influence, which causes variability in there in terms of global temperatures and tropical ocean temperatures, but overall at a global scale, that those warmer oceans are going to stay there. There's going to be more moisture in the atmosphere for rainfall and flooding. And that's super important for Australia, because we're, in terms of what's coming this year, it's looking like we will go into a wet La Niña influence this year. So those record warmer ocean temperatures around Australia could well support record rainfall and flooding in the second half of 2024 for Australia. And that particularly impacts the eastern states, but it does impact South Australia as well. So for people living in Adelaide, it'd be really good year to just make sure all of your guttering is all sorted out, and anything that supports managing flood risk, rainfall and runoff is just sorted out over the next few months before we go into a very wet, what's potentially a very wet spring and summer. And so that's one aspect of concerning things in the last couple of years. There's other things like there's high resolution modelling suggesting the West Antarctic ice sheet, which has got 3.5 metres of sea level rise, locked up, and it is much more susceptible to collapse than the course of resolution modelling suggested. And it's even if we could keep things to 1.5 degrees, it's looking, there's some recent modelling suggesting that that could still collapse over time. It's the stuff that can take a while to roll out. But once again, there's Hansen suggesting that could happen in the next sort of 100 years or so, over a few decades, contributing to, we could see in the next 100-150 years, we could see 1 to 2 metres of sea level rise happening.
Much. 1 to 2 metres.
Yeah, so some of the low likelihood, high impact sea level rise scenarios the IPCC has been talking about now looking quite a bit more likely. And then just to sort of cap it off, Sue, there's been quite a number of different avenues of work looking at the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. So global circulation system, which starts off in the North Atlantic, from the freezing of ocean water to form the Arctic ice sheet, Now that's been happening less because the Arctic's warming up more, and that cold, salty water that's left over from the ice formation sinks down into the North Atlantic and makes its way around the world, into the Southern Hemisphere, comes up through the tropics, around Australia, picks up heat from the tropics, and then makes its way up into the Northern Hemisphere. Part of that's up through the Gulf Stream, and it keeps, you know, Europe quite a bit warmer. This is where that sort of concern about Europe getting quite a bit colder if this all shuts down, and that's showing signs of weakening. But the modelling generally suggests that that shutdown is not likely to happen in this century. But there's more recent work and other sort of observation indicators suggesting it could shut down by around mid-century, so in the next 20, 30 years potentially. Now the trouble with that, Sue, for us in Australia and the Southern Hemisphere is that heat, which is currently going up into the Northern Hemisphere, will stay in the Southern Hemisphere, so that means we see a step change in over maybe 10, 20 years in temperatures of about a degree or so in the Southern Hemisphere. And then there's concern about, it's really not known yet whether that means we'll get more El Niños or more La Niñas as a result of that change. That's one of the big questions. But there is some work suggesting that could enhance the whole La Niña type signal. Mm. So we get even more enhanced flooding, we get moisture coming off, you know, even warmer ocean temperatures. And then, I guess the other concern with the possible underestimation of the model sensitivity to greenhouse gases is the other work. There's lots of work on tipping points like the Arctic permafrost feedback. So the Arctic's warming up, the frozen ground starts warming up, turning into bog, starts decomposing, producing its own methane and carbon dioxide. And there's work suggesting that could add about 10%, equivalent to about 10% of human emissions through the 21st century. But the overall volume of potential greenhouse gases is about twice what's already in the atmosphere. So we've got 420 parts per million now. That feedback over time, over a few centuries, could actually push things up to the 1,000 or more ppm parts per million of carbon dioxide level.
What does that mean for people?
Well, it means we're quite possibly stuck on a pathway where, you know, without radical reductions in emissions and probably even pulling down greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere that we've put into the atmosphere already through things like direct air capture and revegetation and seaweed farming and that sort of thing, unless you start pulling those levels back down again, we're possibly locked into a future which could carry on to, you know, sort of 4 or 5 degrees. And once we get over sort of, I don't know, 2.5, 3 degrees, that sort of amount of warming basically melts all of the major ice sheets on the Earth, including Antarctica. And that results in 70 metres or so of global sea level rise in time. So it's basically, you know, we're looking incredibly close to a pathway which will massively transform the planet over coming centuries.
What can we tell politicians this?
James Hansen is considered a little bit... He's an excellent climate scientist, been around for a long time and does excellent work. He's probably considered to be a little more on the... paying more attention to some of the possible... stronger sensitivities in the climate system than some people are... Some of the scientists acknowledge. So there's still wide ranges of opinion, but I think we're in this stage at the moment where it's quite clearly the last year has demonstrated there's really some unusual stuff going on, and so there's going to be a lot of reassessment of the where we're at and reevaluation of what that means for our policies. I mean, all of this stuff reinforces that net zero by 2050, particularly if we keep fudging along the way we're going at the moment, where we're still, you know, carbon emission budgets, we run out of carbon emission budgets, we keep going at anything near current emissions for the next sort of 10 years or so, we're going to blow it all and possibly set us on this extreme pathway. So net zero by 2050 is just no longer a, you know, a scientifically safe policy perspective to be holding. You know, that's a policy position which people have landed on probably in most countries, at least in word, over the last 10 years or so. But the reality is we're not acting anywhere near enough to meet that, and that net zero by 2050 is no longer a particularly good target scientifically. So we're lucky to, hopefully we'll see a massive re-evaluation of things, but we don't have time to muck around with it.
So is 2030 possible?
Well, I've been following Saul Griffith's work on electrifying everything, and there is a potential pathway there.
Mm.
But we've still got governments in lots and lots of places who are still allowing exploration and licensing of new deposits, and the fossil fuel companies are still acting to try and use as much of the stuff they've got valued into the into their companies, despite the fact we've got four times more identified reserves already than we need to stay below 2 degrees. So we're in this position where it's difficult to feel particularly good about the space we're in, because there's a potential pathway there, but we've got lots and lots of roadblocks and hurdles slowing things down. It's not happening quickly enough, and the news is just getting worse and worse in the climate science perspective.
Mm. What would you tell people that they can do?
Well, every kilogram of carbon dioxide counts at the moment, so there's lots of things we can do on a personal scale. So reducing meat emissions, try to minimise your flying, make sure you try and do low emissions transport, get into the solar panels and the batteries and all that sort of stuff, and all that's getting cheaper and cheaper. Really get stuck in the politicians and keep pushing and saying it's a net zero by 2050 is no longer safe. And we need to really get stuck in. And the politicians are worried about getting voted out if they go too strongly with things. So that's the only way around that is if people call loudly enough and strongly enough that politicians can feel confident about taking stronger steps. There's probably some need for a bit of transparency around, some of the influence that fossil fuel interests have on our policies, on our decision makers as well.
And I believe that's huge.
Yeah, we're still, the fossil fuel industry had a big conference on a few weeks ago, and they're basically saying, the transition's all happening too slowly, so a bit like, we shouldn't be too bothered, It's just so completely at odds. They're so obviously not interested in taking the action needed. And they have powerful influence on different levels of government.
One of the things I can do is see if I can get this out there.
Yeah, it is frightening stuff to contemplate in terms of where that we could well end up set on this quite disturbing pathway for humanity over the rest of this century. And, I have to get a bit detached about it in terms of my feelings around it, but to kind of just keep going on with life. Yeah, it does raise questions about how do we end up in this situation? Mm. We've had resources be pulled out of all different agencies and organisations and science, support for science to understand all this stuff over the last sort of 30, 40 years, and when we need to be doing exactly the opposite. And it's left us in a situation where we're not, we haven't been able to pick this up as well as we could have. So there's some questions are there about how well our decision-making processes and our priorities are aligned with, in terms of doing what we need to do.
In terms of development, there should be more Christie Walks.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's all sorts of questions around that. Australians have got some of the biggest homes in the world. We've got some of the least energy efficient homes in the world. And so, how is that being allowed to happen?
Mm.
energy efficiency just seems to have fallen completely off the radar in terms of actions around climate change, when it's one of the most productive and cost-effective things that you can do. You can save a heap of money. We don't have the building codes, the building systems and the development processes to support that by any means. It's all just throw it up as quick as you can, and it doesn't matter if it leaks heat all over the place. Just bolt an air conditioner on the side and away you go. It's a pretty significant contributor to greenhouse gases, let alone, you know, the design of urban planning and that sort of thing, which supports car use and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it feels almost like we're determined to take ourselves down down the hardest pathway that we can.
Exactly.
Mm.
Well, thank you. My learning just increased.
Thanks, Sue.
Mm.